Our second speaker this evening is a great soldier and a great public servant. He has recently discharged one of the most difficult diplomatic missions which could be imposed on any American. And he has given us the fruits of his experience in that mission in a remarkable book which combines something of the objectivity of the scholar with the penetrating realism of a man of affairs. I shall not rehearse his biography to you, as it is printed on the program, but I shall merely express my great sense of privilege at introducing to you General Walter Beadle Smith, who will speak on the individual and the state in the Soviet Union. General Smith.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, as I listened to the gentle philosopher who preceded me, it occurred to me that he had dedicated himself to a religious life in the same year during which I became an officer in our regular army, and that the difference between our respective callings was no greater than the difference in the relationship between the individual and the state of Gandhi and Nehru on the one hand, and the state of Lenin and Stalin on the other. Nations, like men, are slow to change their natures or their characteristics, even though a political system may change overnight, usually in a convulsion of violence. The national characteristic begins to assert itself, and in time it exercises a profound influence on any political system. Thus, many of the characteristics of citizen-state relationships which exist in the Soviet Union today and which are so foreign to our own concept become comprehensible when they are viewed in the reflected light of Russia's culture and history. I believe that two factors impressed me more than any others as having fundamental influence on the organization of Soviet society. The first of these is that all the organizational concepts are Russian. It is essential to bear in mind that Marx and Engels were historical analysts, preoccupied almost exclusively with the question of when and how to make a revolution. They gave very little attention to what would take place after that revolution occurred in the event that it was successful. Although Marx did discuss briefly the organization of the post-revolutionary German state. And in this connection, it's worthwhile remembering that in this discussion, he drew a very sharp line of demarcation between the workers, that is, the forces of communism, and the Democrats, whose probable line of political action the workers were to oppose and defeat. In all the thousands of pages that he wrote during his lifetime, Marx used the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat only once. The Russian revolutionaries adopted this phrase for their ideological propaganda, but they've demonstrated in practice a fact that has been proved repeatedly in history, that any dictatorship is unlikely to be more than one man and has never been known to encompass anything more than a very limited oligarchy. Consequently, the organizational framework of Soviet communism is mainly Russian, and it was developed by Lenin and Stalin on the basis of the age-old czarist Russian traditions of despotic power and absolute control. It would be a very great mistake to fail to appreciate this fact, or to fail to realize that it is unlikely that any system of government was capable of arising from the dark depths of Russian history, which could really understand and could really sympathize with the hopes and the aspirations of those states whose concepts of government have issued from the great progressive and liberal traditions that have marked the steady rise of Western civilization. The second factor is the complete control that is exercised by the Bolshevik Party in the Soviet Union. The government, the various economic administrations, and the innumerable social organizations in the Soviet Union are operational, or their service organs, and they have very little to do with the determination of policy. That's a party matter. Almost 100 years ago, a very distinguished French political observer remarked that the Russian spirit consists in the hatred of the individual and his absorption into the state to the advantage of despotism. Today, the communist leadership of the Soviet Union is as profoundly disbelieving of the ability of the people to regulate their own lives or to govern themselves as did their czarist predecessors. The writings of Lenin and Stalin leave no question whatever on this point. Both have said categorically, and I quote, "The dictatorship of the proletariat is substantially the dictatorship of the Communist Party." Thus, the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat comes actually to mean dictatorship over the proletariat. And that's something which you should always have in mind. Here is a very characteristic passage from Lenin on this very theme. Lenin is speaking to the party. He said, "Classes are led by parties, and parties are led by individuals who are called leaders. This is ABC. The will of the class is sometimes fulfilled by a dictator. Soviet socialist democracy is not in the least incompatible with the individual rule of a dictatorship. What is necessary is the recognition of individual rule, the recognition of the dictatorial power of one man." By communist theory, as socialism is built, this dictatorship and the state itself will wither away. The fact that both state and dictatorship are obviously growing more robust as time goes on can only be explained by the logic of dialectics, which I must say seems to me at times to have been devised to enable one to swallow contradictions. 2 years ago, I copied from the newspaper Moscow Bolshevik this brief dissertation on the state's relationship to the individual in the Soviet Union. The Soviet state determines the behavior and activity of Soviet citizens in various ways. It educates the Soviet people in a spirit of communist morality by a system which introduces a series of legal norms regulating the life of the population, imposing interdictions, establishing encouragements, and naming punishments for the violation of these norms. The Soviet state stands guard over these legal norms with all its power. The conduct and activity of the Soviet people is also determined by the force of a public opinion which is created by the activity of numerous state organizations. In creating public opinion, the decisive role is played by the Communist Party and the Soviet state, which through various media formulates public opinion and educates the people in a spirit of public awareness. The suavest definition of national regimentation, I think, that I have ever read, but quite consistent with what I have said before. Now, the party which plays this decisive role, remember, please, is a minority group which numbers less than 1/30 of the population. There are, at the present time, less than 6 million members in the Communist Party Bolshevik. But it is by law the only political party that is permitted to exist in the Soviet state. I think its members must carry always with them the sense of insecurity, which inevitably must haunt those who have seized power by violence and who exercise power through force, and that this preoccupation with its own security by a minority party has produced the all-pervading political system which we in this country have come to refer to as a police state, a system under which the state begins to determine and regulate the behavior and the activities of its citizens almost from birth and continues this regulation as long as they live. In the Soviet Union, state control starts with the child. In a country where work is obligatory for both parents, children become part-time wards of the state at a very early age, and the Soviet state guards carefully its most precious commodity. The Soviet educational system is designed to ensure the perpetuation in power of the Communist Party and the exclusion of all political thought except that dictated by the party line. The teaching of nationalism is intimately connected with political education. Its purpose is to arouse boundless devotion to the Soviet Union in its struggle to establish the Soviet regime. It's an interesting fact that the Soviet child enters the Red Pioneers at about the same age that our children enter the Cub Scouts and the Brownies. From the Pioneers, the children graduate into the Komsomol, the youth organization which gives political shop group training and which, at about the age of 26, will graduate into the Communist Party those relatively few selected individuals who demonstrate the intelligence, the ability, and the response to discipline to qualify them as party members. Higher education is reserved to a great extent for those who develop a political consciousness to a very high degree. As a matter of fact, the economic future of the Soviet young man or young woman depends to a very large extent on the development of his political progress. When the young Soviet citizen leaves the direct supervision of his teacher, he comes in one way or another under the all-pervading eye of the secret police. Russia has had a secret police for hundreds of years, and for hundreds of years, the secret police has been a hated institution. The destruction of the Okhrana, the Tsar's secret police organization, was one of the most popular slogans of the Communist Party during the period of the revolution. However, immediately after seizing power, the Bolsheviks established as an agency of the young Soviet state the All-Russian Extraordinary Commission, which soon became known to the Soviet people and to the world as the Cheka, a name which was derived from the initials of Extraordinary Commission. And that name still conveys the impression of terror, regarding which Lenin said bluntly and frankly, "The purpose of the terror is to terrify." It's an amazing fact that the Soviet people have become acclimated to the knock on the door at midnight and the disappearance of a father or a brother or any other relative. But they have become acclimated over a period of years and over a period of centuries. I think it's probably the nameless dread which attaches itself to the secret police organization that has been one of the reasons for its nomenclatural evolution from Cheka through Gepu and OGPU and NKVD to the present form, MVD, Ministry of State Security. The Communist Party didn't reestablish the secret police without apologies to the people whose lives the state intended to regulate. An early issue of the Soviet Encyclopedia says this: the apparatus of compulsion, the GPU, the courts, and the prisons, is retained temporarily only while the resistance of the bourgeoisie continues. But these instruments of struggle will wither away in proportion as the resistance declines. The state will disappear together with the division of society into classes. As long ago as 1939, Stalin himself declared, the function of compulsion inside the country has ceased, has withered away. This was in 1939. The exploiters are no more, and there is no one to suppress anymore. But there is no slightest indication that the secret police are about to wither away. On the contrary, they've steadily increased in strength and power under the present regime, and the organization has become a permanent feature of Soviet life today as it was in the days of the Tsars, with this difference, that the MVD exceeds in efficiency its Tsarist predecessors by as great a degree as the present tightly integrated, effective governmental organization exceeds in efficiency the weak and venal Tsarist governments which preceded them. Now, this is a violent contradiction. And the violent contradiction which this perpetuation of the secret police system involves between communist ideals and current practice has had to be resolved dialectically. Accordingly, the party line now depicts the secret police as the guardian angels of the Soviet people against foreign conspiracy and enemy agents, foreign and domestic. The agencies of state security have complete supervision over every phase of national life in the Soviet Union. The Foreign Office can't even give out a visa to a diplomatic attaché without the approval of the men of the Lubyanka, in the shadow of which the Foreign Office stands physically. They're right next door to each other. These men, the men of the secret police, and there are approximately a million of them, half in uniform and half out, have a vested interest in insecurity. That's a rather remarkable thing, but it's the truth. The growth and influence of the police state machine have been directly proportional to the fears on which it feeds. And it all goes back to this basic feeling of insecurity on the part of the Bolshevik Party, which still persists in spite of its increased strength as a result of enormous victories in war. The Soviet people have been for 30 years, economically at least, in a sort of a state of siege. They've been called on to work harder and to get along with less in the way of material compensation for a longer period than any people can accept without protest, unless there is provided some form of stimulus, and a very powerful stimulus. And the state provides this stimulus in the form of a series of enemies. First, there were the bourgeoisie to be exterminated. Then the Trotskyite wreckers, then the actual and deadly threat of Germany. There's always been capitalist encirclement with the threat of sabotage. And lest this become shop-worn, the new bogey of a warmongering United States is brought out and paraded every day. The statement that these threats existed has always necessitated strict and unquestioned obedience on the part of the population to the edicts of the state. Uncomplaining acceptance and hard work may bring a reward of a carrot in the form of a decoration or more material gain. But any other attitude is certain to bring the whip, and the whip is wielded by the secret police. There's nothing that the people can do about it. They go to the polls and vote, but a Soviet election is simply a political puppet show in which the masses dance to the strings pulled by the party. I've seen 3 of these elections. Externally, the purpose of the election is to conceal the reality of police state behind a constitutional facade. And internally, they constitute a gigantic organized demonstration in which the populace registers solidarity with the machine, whether they like it or not. And I would like to emphasize here that the masses of the Russian people actually believe, I think, that they enjoy the fruits of democracy because they have no standard of comparison. They can go to the polls and vote. The fact that they're voting for one candidate selected by one party doesn't really mean very much to them. They can take their places in the legislative bodies of their county or of their state, the rayon, or of their national republic, or even of the Soviet Union. And the fact that in that capacity, they act merely as rubber stamps, which, as I have seen, will pass a national budget in 14 minutes, is not particularly significant. Because, again, they have no standard of comparison. The fact is, of course, that the Soviet government would find it impossible to operate without the secret police, the security organization, which is the cement that binds together the whole framework of the national organization. It's not only the agency of political control, but actually it's the cornerstone of the Soviet economic structure. Beginning with the first camp on the Solovetsky Islands in the White Sea during 1923, the Soviet government has expanded the old Russian system of penal labor into an enormous economic organization for the exploitation and development of those areas of the Soviet Union where life is unusually hard and difficult and where even the greatest inducements would not attract free labor. This system of prison camps and forced labor seems to satisfy in part both political and economic requirements of the Soviet system. And as a former inmate of one of these camps said to me on occasion, no free men would do the work assigned to prisoners. So long as there is work to be done under subhuman conditions, just that long will there be prison labor in the Soviet Union. A great deal has been written regarding life in these Soviet concentration camps and the summary form of justice practiced in the Soviet Union. But I don't believe it's been sufficient entirely to convince the people of other countries of the lack of personal liberty which exists in a police form of state. Actually, from our point of view, it doesn't make a great deal of difference whether there are 1 million or 10 million slave laborers in the Soviet economy. That fact is less important than is the fact that under the Soviet regime, large numbers of individuals are deprived of their liberty and sent to concentration camps solely for political and economic reasons. That is the important thing to remember. It can only occur in a police state type of organization. The most important functions of the state security, however, I must again remind you, are the neutralization of political opposition, not only in the party, outside the party, but inside the party and on the highest levels. The public and private life of every party member is under continuous scrutiny by the secret police, and the higher his position in the state, the more carefully he is watched. I doubt if anybody, except possibly Stalin and the members of the Politburo, are really immune to secret police surveillance. The average Soviet citizen, on the other hand, is conscious of the secret police only in a rather negative way. So long as he stays where he is registered, does his work, and refrains from comment or criticism of the party or of the Soviet regime. But if he steps aside, even a very short way, from the routine pattern that he is expected to follow by the party, he is arrested at once, and his relatives and friends are likely to be arrested with him. I'd lived in Moscow a long time before I began to appreciate the fact that the Soviet citizen is conditioned mentally to the chances of arrest, about the way that we in this country are conditioned mentally to the chances of being struck by an automobile when we cross the street. And his protective reaction to the one type of danger are as automatic and as unostentatious as ours are to the other type. We don't stop and offer a silent prayer when we come to a street corner. We react more or less automatically, and so does the Soviet man in the street to the other type of danger. The fatalistic attitude of the intellectual toward political arrest is remarkable to me. I had a number of friends who were arrested, and one well-known critic who anticipated and predicted the intellectual purge of 1947 said to a friend of mine that the new Siberian railroads will be built on the bones of people like myself. And this man was arrested about a year later. In the field of economy, the peculiar relationship between the individual and the authoritarian state are more obvious and are more readily understandable. Work in the Soviet Union, of course, is a duty for every able-bodied citizen. The working population is classified into industrial workers, farm workers, and government workers. The latter include office employees and members of the profession. All workers must be members of a local or state authority or a cooperative society. Of course, as you know, no person may hire another except that a privileged few are allowed by the government to employ domestic help. All industry and all business belongs to the state. Agriculture is collectivized or state-operated. Conditions under which the workers toil have created many problems of labor discipline. But the government arbitrarily meets these problems by curtailing the freedom of the individual to change his job and by imposing severe penalties, including fines and imprisonment, for tardiness or absence from work. And this is no joke. They really go to prison if they are absent from work or are tardy several times without a sufficient explanation. Thus, the basis of the entire Soviet economic structure is compulsory labor in one form or another. You cannot quit your job unless you have the permission of the factory manager and the political representative in the plant. Soviet worker is drafted into training schools, is required to work at a given job, and is forbidden to move from one place of work to another without official permission. Now, that would be very shocking to us, and we could hardly accept it. But a system of this kind has been more or less prevalent in Russia for centuries, and the Russian people can accept it without too much strain. They're used to it. The Soviet Union has a constitution, and on first reading, it's an impressive constitution, adopted in 1936 and amended in 1947. It carries a statement of the fundamental rights of citizens, including the right to work, the right to rest and leisure, maintenance in old age and sickness, education, equal rights respective of age, sex, nationality or race, freedom of religious worship and anti-religious propaganda, and freedom of speech, press, and assembly. Every time I used to read those last three, I'd have the colic. In practice, most of these provisions exist on paper only, because they are nullified by a qualifying clause which prescribes that these rights must be exercised, quote, in conformity with the interests of the working people and in order to strengthen the socialist system, unquote. And there you are. It's the party, through the agency of the secret police and other organs of compulsion, which determines whether the exercise of these so-called constitutional rights affects the interest of the state, and the operations of Soviet law thus come to have a very different objective and a very different meaning from the impartial administration of justice, which is the ideal of Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence. In his authoritative work on criminal procedure, Mr. Vyshinsky says, "The primary duty of the Soviet judicial system lies in its protection of the class interests of the worker. The judicial system is the arm of the workers and peasants who dispose of the power of the state and use it to further their own interest against other classes." To evaluate the true meaning of these words, you have to recall what I've already said. Since the Communist Party is exercising dictatorship in the name of the workers, Mr. Vyshinsky's words mean that the Soviet judicial system is the arm of party dictatorship, which disposes the power of the state to further its interests as against the rights of the individual. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union has so far resolutely denied any real freedom of choice to the individual citizens of the Soviet state. And this principle of authoritarian state control is now being applied to the entire area of communist influence in Europe, and I believe will be in Asia. It is this, to us, of course, unthinkable relationship between the state and its citizens, and not the conflict between free economic enterprise on the one hand and state capitalism or collectivism on the other, which has created the basic issue of our time. And it is a mistake to try to reduce this conflict to a question of free enterprise versus collectivization. The actual issue is whether human beings are to be entrusted with the freedom of choice to determine their own government and their cultural outlook and their own economic system, or whether these are to be chosen for them by a very small minority political party. It's a grave mistake to attempt to reduce the ideological conflict between communism and democracy to any other issue. It can't be done. No matter how many political or economic evils exist in a democratic state, they're correctable, so long as the processes of criticism, opposition, and education are not monopolized by a minority political party and supervised by a secret police organization. And if they are, they are not correctable, at least not by any effort of the people themselves. So having seen at first hand the other side of the picture, I can repeat with deep feeling the statement of one of my early predecessors in Moscow, our minister, Mr. Brown, who wrote in a dispatch dated January 27, 1853, "This is the best school in which to Americanize our countrymen that perhaps can be found. They are enabled to view their own government by the law of contrast and inspect it from new points of observation. And I envy not him who can do so and return without an increased attachment to our institutions." Thank you.
I'm sure that we have gained new insight into the political philosophies of two great states by these remarkable addresses this evening. And I want to thank you Swami Nihilananda and General Smith for the contribution you have made to our enlightenment. The next meeting of this conference will take place tomorrow morning at 10:15 a.m. at the Strong Auditorium. The central theme will be social rights and obligations, and the speakers will be Ralph Johnson Bunch, who will speak on the United Nations peace effort in Palestine, and Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt, who will speak on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the United Nations. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.